We've become strangers to death in the West. While death cafes and live-tweeted final moments might seem morbid novelties, they represent desperate attempts to reclaim what we've lost only recently, our ability to discuss death openly. This taboo is strikingly new, emerging just 150 years ago when we began replacing direct language about mortality with euphemisms and avoidances. Meanwhile, in many cultures worldwide, death remains an everyday conversation. As one Indian respondent noted, death is discussed from the time the first pet or granduncle dies. Our medical establishments now fight death at all costs, with companies like Google's Calico investing billions to literally cure death. Yet despite these efforts, everything dies. This universal truth connects us across time and culture, from ancient burial rituals to modern hospice care. What makes humans unique isn't just that we die, but that we know we will die. Unlike animals who primarily recognize death as an event, we understand it as both event and process. This awareness begins remarkably early. Children often contemplate mortality while observing dead insects or questioning what happens to elderly relatives. Even as we live, we experience small deaths daily. Our body completely regenerates itself every 7 to 10 years, with different tissues replacing themselves at varying rates. The transition from the abstract, "I will die someday," to the immediate, "I am dying," represents a fundamental shift in perspective that often prompts deep reflection on life's meaning and legacy. Western society has medicalized grief, creating a surveillance of sadness. The DSM-5 suggests grief beyond 2 months may indicate mental disorder, despite research showing many grieve intensely for years without dysfunction. Traditional outlets like pastoral counseling and mourning periods have diminished, leaving the bereaved without meaningful rituals and feeling pressured to move on prematurely. Modern Western funerals typically occur within days, allowing little time for personalization. Many find conventional rites unsatisfying, with standardized prayers and brief services failing to address grief's depth. The funeral industry's efficiency focus has stripped death rituals of emotional power. The service is mistakenly viewed as concluding grief when it's actually just the beginning, a misconception leaving mourners isolated when their pain persists. This ritual vacuum has contributed to society's focus on avoiding death through medical intervention. From Nobel Prize winner Alexis Carrel's 1912 claim that death is not necessary to modern promises of life extension, Western culture emphasizes fighting death rather than accepting its inevitability. Silicon Valley invests billions in longevity research while grief support remains underfunded, pressuring the dying to maintain a battle narrative and making death even more devastating when it arrives. Examining unfamiliar death practices reveals profound insights about mortality. Tibetan sky burial, ritually dissecting the dead and offering remains to birds, serves as both a practical solution in the treeless Himalayas and reflects Buddhist beliefs about rebirth. The body, merely a vessel, is returned to nature. This practice parallels Western embalming in its purpose. Buddhist teacher Trungpa Rinpoche noted, "Dying is harder in the West because the truth of death is hidden from us." Grief often manifests as rage, challenging Western conceptions of normal grieving. The Ilongot people of the Philippines practiced headhunting as a ritual response to grief. Anthropologist Renato Rosaldo only understood this after his wife's death, when his own overwhelming rage helped him comprehend that the Ilongot used severed heads to carry away unbearable grief. All cultures need rituals to process grief. Without them, grief becomes unmanageable, as demonstrated when headhunting was outlawed, forcing grieving Ilongot to seek alternatives like Christianity. Victorian death culture included practices that would shock us today, like photographing the dead posed in lifelike positions. This marked a shift from earlier traditions of simple body wrapping and churchyard burials. Victorians developed elaborate customs around coffins, public cemeteries, and memorialization, creating an entire mourning industry. Queen Victoria, who wore black weeds for life after Albert's death, popularized public mourning. Widows followed strict stages from first-year black crepe to eventual half-mourning in gray or purple. Between 1850-1880, hair jewelry flourished, with accessories made from the deceased's hair. Photography, emerging in the 1830s, often captured the dead posed as if alive. Victorian death culture eventually declined as people abandoned practices like keeping locks of hair or bodies at home. Funeral parlors assumed death duties, and relics lost significance. This shift paralleled industrialization, war trauma, and modern life's acceleration. Modern Westerners lost the communal aspects of death and mourning that had once defined these experiences. As medicine embraced cadavers for education, bodies became commodities. The 1832 Anatomy Act allowed unclaimed paupers' bodies to be used by medical schools, a practice the poor dreaded. Resurrectionists worked nightly with wooden shovels for silence and ropes for extraction, creating tension between medical professionals and the public. Between 1880 to 1930, American medical students took dissection room photographs as a rite of passage. Some images showed corpses posed with cigarettes or arranged playing poker, while others featured students posing as cadavers. These students' dream photos suggested, if the corpse is mere object, then so am I. Modern medical education increasingly adopts corpse-free anatomy using digital programs and synthetic bodies, raising the question, if medical education abandons direct contact with actual corpses, who will understand death's physical reality? Defining death has grown complicated in our technological age. The paradigm shift began in 1947 when Claude Beck successfully defibrillated a heart. Ventilators followed in the 1950s, capable of sustaining comatose patients indefinitely, creating situations where bodies could function after consciousness had ceased. Hospice care offers an alternative to hospital death, focusing on quality of life rather than cure. While doctors provide essential palliative services, it falls to the rest of us to provide the meaning. Good hospice workers possess exceptional compassion. It isn't a job, one worker explains. It seems to be a calling. Death over dinner began when Michael Hebb discovered that 50% of Americans don't die as they hope to. The organization facilitates dinner conversations about death, providing reading materials and conversation starters. Similar concepts like John Underwood's Death Cafe have spread globally, with baby boomers being the largest participants. The natural death movement offers an alternative to conventional funeral practices, allowing families to handle death preparations themselves. The Natural Death Handbook guides sitting with the dying, washing the body, and preparing natural funerals. This approach has spread with woodland burial sites and natural burial grounds. Family participation in these rituals becomes part of the healing process. Though Western culture has distanced itself from traditional death rituals, we continue seeking meaningful practices. The rituals we've abandoned often reappear in new forms because ancient human needs persist in modern contexts. A good ritual is simply one that helps and heals. The key is choosing deliberately and discussing death while still healthy, gathering grain before winter comes. That's the value of death's summer coat, recognizing that ephemeral things become lovely in their brevity, suggesting that death, too, has an unexpected beauty that will be followed by a new spring.